I titled this session "The Monopoly," and this morning I got worried because people were making fun of me and said the next day I'm going to take Mealborn. It's a dialogue on economic power. I find that an awful lot of my friends are convinced that monopolies are a major threat to the performance of the American economy, to the American way of life, to the world. Sometimes they spread it out and say monopolies and oligopolies. Sometimes they say large corporations. It isn't quite clear what my friends mean, because when I talk about my friends, I don't mean economists. Very few of my friends are economists, or maybe I should say very few economists are friendly. But I mean the people with whom I primarily associate, who are in fields like religion, English, my parents, people at Holden Village, good people generally. We're concerned about the state of the world. Is the American economy dominated by monopolies? Sometimes you hear the argument that, well, back in the 19th century, there was a lot of competition, but in the 20th century, big corporations have taken over and the economy no longer works the way it used to. Well, what we believe on this question, the state of American public opinion, is very important, because what the government is going to do by way of regulating the economy will depend largely on what the public thinks is the case. Even if the public is completely misinformed, I think we've seen, I won't get into specific examples, but I think we have seen in recent years how adept government officials are at doing what they know is stupid, because a majority of the public seems to want them to do it. It happens, I should warn you, that last winter I was encouraged by a foundation to apply for a grant. I'd been interested in this problem of economic power and public attitudes on economic power, and I was encouraged by a foundation to apply for a grant, which I haven't yet finished doing, so I don't know whether I'll get the grant. But there's a good chance that I'll be spending part of the next 2 years doing research on the question of economic power in as many and as broad a meaning of the... I'm going to be doing research onto whatever Americans mean by economic power. And what my first task will be to find out what do Americans mean by it when they complain about monopolies and oligopolies. And then the next question will be, how much substance is there to their fears? Are we getting paranoid, or are there really problems out there? I've done a good deal of preliminary thinking about it, and I'll tell you frankly, I am extremely skeptical about the notion that the American economy is dominated by monopolists and oligopolists or super corporations or multinational corporations. I am not persuaded that big corporations are a serious threat to anything. The bell is more of a threat to our world.
You know the class wins are fast.
Yeah, well, that means I'm supposed to begin. If there are people, I thought of beginning with a poll, but probably be so difficult to set the question that we wouldn't know what the answers meant. But let me ask you, if I were to make a statement, I'd like to know whether you feel you would tend to agree or tend to disagree, or whether you would have really genuinely have no opinion. Here's the proposition. We have to have some kind of price and wage controls in the American economy nowadays, because prices are no longer set competitively, and if we don't have some controls, the big monopolies, business and unions are going to cause inflation. True. How many of you would tend to think that's... How many of you are quite sure that's wrong?
Since I'm one of your friends, I'm supposed to think that that's right.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, how many of you suspect that a lot of the energy crisis has been cooked up by the big oil companies? That they're responsible for a good bit of the oil crisis.
I would say. That's just the way I
think. Yeah, that's true. So, I don't have any. The mere fact that I suspect does not prove anything. I thought it's a dialogue in economic power. I want to say a few things this morning. I want to suggest a couple of ways of looking at these problems. I want to suggest that there are really a rather large number of distinct problems here. I want to maybe give you some way of avoiding the worst forms of nonsense. There's some things you don't want to believe because you can easily be refuted. And then I'd like to respond to questions. You know, if some of you have fears about corporate size, multinational corporations, or whatever, monopoly pricing, or, well, you talk, and let's see, maybe I know something about it, and maybe I don't, and let's see where we land. I'm really interested in getting, see, I'm doing research here now, trying to get a sense of what the great unwashed public really thinks.
How can you tell?
Came in the right place.
Well, Carol was complaining again that the sauna was underused. Carol has this ridiculous idea that you can't get clean without going in the sauna. But the basic question is, how much power do which corporations have to do what? When we talk about the power of corporations, that's really very vague. Sure, corporations have power. If they didn't have power, they couldn't win. They couldn't produce anything. They have to have some power. They have to have the power to organize resources. But how much power do which corporations have, and to do what? Let me begin by talking about the meaning of the word monopoly, because monopoly is the word the bad word that we most often use to condemn all these evil corporations. A monopoly means literally a single seller. It comes from two Greek words, one seller. Well, how many monopolists are there? That is, how many sole sellers of products are there in the United States? There's no answer to that question, because if you define the product broadly enough, there are no monopolists at all. And if you define the product narrowly enough, every seller is a monopolist. I mean, like I say, you're living in Dallas, Texas, and you want to buy milk. How many sellers of milk are there? You say, oh, lots of them. But now suppose it's 10 o'clock at night. The baby is screaming. There's no milk in the house. And you don't have a car. How many sellers of milk are there? There is one three blocks away, a convenience store that stays open till 11 o'clock at night. The next store that is open and selling milk is 7 miles away. Now, how many sellers of milk are there? There's only one. He's a monopolist, in a sense. But of course, it's a degree. He couldn't, if he went in there and you said, I'd like a, now just suppose you go in there and you say, I'd like a quart of milk. He says, that'll be $1.25. You say, $1.25 for a quart of milk? You say, yeah. Would you pay it? Chances are you would. You know, he's gotcha. But he's not likely to do that, because what would happen? You'd be much more careful about not running out of milk again.
Yeah. And you wouldn't go there.
Well, the thing is, you might, if you ever got in that bind again, you wouldn't. See, if you ever, but you'd try to stay out of that bind. Moreover, there are people, see, who live sort of halfway between him and the other convenience store, and he kind of wants their business too. So the fact, he may have you at, this is an interesting thing to keep in mind, the seller may have you at his mercy, but if he can't tell the difference between you and other people whom he has less at his mercy, he won't treat you quite so villainously. Just think about that. There are an example. One of the industries that I think can easily be demonstrated, it's highly competitive. Although, interestingly enough, this does not seem to convince the American public. They still think that the retail grocery stores are in some big conspiracy to raise prices. But one of the most highly competitive industries, one that has kept prices low and quality of product good. Of course, some people argue about what is good quality of product. But they've given people what they wanted. The American consumer has shown that if he or she wants it, the supermarkets will provide it, and they'll provide it at amazingly low cost. And you just think of the extraordinary range of goodies that you have spread out before you when you walk into a Safeway store. Right there, you know, you can just get everything. It's fantastic. And think of all of them, the people that cooperated in getting that stuff out there at a really remarkably low price. Well, this is a highly competitive business. And in the process of explaining that, I forgot to point it.
People think they're monopolists.
Well, yeah, but that wasn't. I was going to make some. I had some tricky illustration in mind. Well, I know. Why are they so? Why is it that when one store cuts the price on something, pretty soon the other stores will tend to cut the prices too on that product? And so we say, well, it's because if the Safeway cuts its prices and the Kroger doesn't, everybody will go over to the Safeway. Well, that's not true. Because most shoppers don't pay that close attention. They tend to go where they've always gone. But the thing is, there are about 10 or 15% of the shoppers who do pay attention. And they make the difference between a profitable week and a non-profitable week. So in the attempt on the part of the managers of the stores to capture those swing shoppers, they lower prices. And they can't tell the difference. Now, they're very astute. They have learned some ways to tell the difference. Why is it that the newspapers on Thursday contain coupons to clip out and take to the store? It's because the people who clip those coupons are the people who read the ads and check the comparative prices. Those are the astute shoppers. So if somebody comes in there with a coupon, the store owner in effect says, aha, you're astute. You're somebody who won't come here unless I give you a lower price, so I'll give you a lower price. Then you come, somebody else comes walking in with no coupon and says, aha, a non-astute shopper, charge him a higher price. So there are ways of discriminating between the astute shoppers and the non-astute shoppers. But insofar as the store owners, the sellers, can't find effective ways to discriminate, we all get the benefit of the bargain hunter. Now, there's some silly people who will spend 6 hours worth of labor and $3 worth of gas and oil to save 7 cents. but we all benefit from them. Those bargain hunters keep the sellers on their toes. All right, well, that was very, very long. I'm certainly glad that I found out where I was regressing to. Let me take an example of what sure looks like a monopolist, the Bell Telephone Company. Now, there are lots of Bell Telephone Companies, of course, so, you know, and really, if you live in St. Louis, you buy from Southwestern Bell, but you can move and buy from a different Bell. Bell, you say, they're all owned by the same kind. But actually, you know, Bell the Bell system is not the only seller of telephone service in the United States. Turns out to be about the only efficient seller of telephone service. People who buy their telephone service from non-Bell companies are usually eager to get taken over by this ferocious, vicious, selfish monopolist, which is interesting. Is Bell the sole seller of the product? Well, it depends on what the product is. If the product is telephone service, all right, for all practical purposes, it is. But suppose you define the product as communication. Then Bell is in competition with the Post Office, Western Union, fast running, loud talking. Well, loud talking. Well, no. See, we tend to think, we can't get along without a telephone. I can't get along without a telephone. Remember that you have allowed yourself to drift into a position of dependence on the telephone. If the telephone suddenly disappeared, you'd learn to get along without it. We probably wouldn't live as far apart. We probably, we might live closer, closer to our friends. I don't know, there are all sorts of things. We communicate with one another less. And by the way, that's another substitute for the telephone, keeping your big mouth shut. and kids, ooh, boy, I just hate it, that phone. My wife and I no longer answer the telephone. It's never for us. And the kid, the boy right across the street calls, instead of walking over. Once they get to be 5 and they discover how to dial, just back and forth, Sarah, little Sarah, will go 2 houses down to her friends and then dial, call us, just to see how we're doing. But there are obviously substitutes for that sort of stuff. But the crux of the issue here, now, You know, and this power of sellers over buyers is one of the things that people have in mind when they talk about the power of monopoly. Now, this question is, how much power do which sellers have to jack up the price? Who has us by the throat? And to what degree? Let me just pause here and ask you, where does substantial, significant market power exist in your experience? Where are the sellers? Who are the sellers whom you suspect have a lot of market power in relation to you? Let's just talk about them. And I'm genuinely asking the question. Let's look at some of the cases.
The automobile industry.
Okay, the automobile industry.
And the automobile repair industry.
Okay, let's separate them though. See, one of the mistakes we don't want to make is simply because automobile is in both of them to assume it's one industry. They're really owned by different people, and they may have interlocking interests, or they may not. We want to go case by case and look very carefully. Now let's take the producers of automobiles. Now, what options do you have? Let's say over against General Motors. All right, yeah. I mean, substitutes for all. There are substitutes for General Motors automobiles. There's Ford, Chrysler, American. There's even the one they make in Kalamazoo, the Checker.
Foreign imports.
There are foreign imports, and that's very important. Very important.
You can keep your car a lot longer and keep it up.
Right. So automobile repair service is in competition with automobile production. Mm-hmm. Then there's carpooling, public transportation,
bicycle,
motorcycles. Right. Now it gets down to the question. How tight's the bind?
Could I put the question a little differently, Paul? It's not just a matter of how tight is the bind financially or inflation or that kind of thing, but also quality of life and values and direction and so on that a lot of these companies, again, in my jaundiced opinion, seem to be directing my life more than I like to have directed by them.
Right, let's come back to that, because that's another important thing that people mean when they talk about monopoly power. Right. But I'm trying to separate those issues. That's another important issue. To what extent are these big corporations really determining the style of our life?
Yeah, the war in Vietnam.
Right. The war in Vietnam.
Why you begin to think, why?
Yeah, okay. But right now, I just want to focus on this business of market power. Market power means the ability to jack a price up well above the cost of production, you know, so that the seller, in effect, makes a big profit. He gets it out of your hide. He's charging you more than he would charge under a competitive situation, where competition would kind of bring prices down to approximately the level of costs. And he's making you pay an awful lot for something because he's kind of got you over the barrel, because you don't have good substitutes. The thing that counters monopoly power in this sense now, market power, is the availability of substitutes. The better, the wider the range of substitutes available to you in any particular case, the less market power any seller has. Now, the automobile, which is the automobile sales, production and sales, the first item you mentioned, may well be one of the most, it may be the worst case of monopoly power.
I think housing.
Well, just a second. Barbara, go.
I think gasoline is more meet your criteria than automobile.
Okay, let's take a look at gasoline.
Right. Yeah.
How many sellers of gasoline are there?
It's not just how many there are, but how much do they cooperate?
All right, now we got a new question. Now, there may be lots of different sellers, but they collude. Okay, and if they collude and they act like one, then in effect you only have one. Well, now, let's think back a little bit. Let's forget the last couple of years when our attention has gotten focused on... Well, no, because, you know, I have a question. If the big increases in the price of gasoline were brought about by collusion among the oil companies, why did they wait so long to do it? Why didn't they do it 20 years earlier? Why did they allow the retail price of gasoline to rise at a rate so much lower than that of the general increase in the level of prices? Why is it that the real relative price of gasoline has been declining even though the demand for gasoline has been increasing.
Well, did they not, in a sense, as a result of the Vietnam War, with all these other areas in which they could reap profits from the government? All your jet fuels, the bombers.
You mean they didn't take advantage of us because they were able to take advantage of the government?
Yeah, all this was coming in there. So why? And then is this other area of resource, of revenue, has been perhaps declining? We've watched this in Tucson. I mean, it's amazing how maybe it'll be a week or 10 days, it'll go up 1 cent, and maybe another week or 10 days, goes up another penny. Gradually, it's going up.
All right, but you can't conclude from the fact that it's going up that it's going up for the reason you say. Let's take the reason you suggest is that they used to make big profits off the government, and then those profits disappeared, and so now they have to make the profits off
declined.
The consumer.
Yeah, I think the profits have
declined. All right, they've declined. But that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If the oil companies could have made big profits off customers, why wouldn't they have simply made those profits and added them to the big profits that they made off the government? I don't find sellers saying that, I'm going to be nice to this guy. I'm not going to make as much off him as I could because I'm making a lot off of him. It's a very common notion that this is the way sellers behave. For example, I asked students once, what do you think would be the effect on the cost of getting a divorce if we passed no-fault automobile insurance? Well, you know, they're kind of stunned. but what I'm after here is, what's this going to do to the prices charged by lawyers? And about half of my students will say the cost of a divorce will go up, because when you get no-fault automobile insurance, then the lawyers aren't going to be able to make as much money off accidents, and so they're going to have to make more money off divorces. I think that's wrong. That is simply wrong.
Why?
Because there's no way they can do it. They make off divorces as much as they can make off divorces. They charge what the market will bear. Now, what's going to happen when they don't have any business, or when they have less business in accidents, there are going to be more lawyers flooding into the divorce business, and prices are going to go down. It just isn't true that when the price of wheat falls, you charge more for your soybeans. you can't do it. Sellers tend to charge the profit-maximizing price. They search for it, and they may not always find it, but they charge what they think is the profit-maximizing price in each market. And there's a lot of evidence that they do that. And so the notion that they will charge more over here because they can no longer charge as much over here, that isn't borne out by the evidence. And it really isn't borne out by the logic of businessmen either. It really assumes that businessmen are noble folk. Now, I'm not anti-businessmen at all, but I don't think they're noble folk who are charging low prices to some people because they're able to make an adequate profit over here. A businessman may say, well, I've got a big home in the country and three automobiles. What do I need more money for? But he won't really say that. He could, but what he's going to say is, what I need more money for is more security for the firm, for expansion. Businessmen always want more profits. I don't know who was next. I think you were, and then you...
Well, I think on your original question on the oil, that for all those years they were getting it cheap from the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now they've realized what they've got, and that's what's caused the biggest pressure.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you think that the real cause was the Arabs and OPEC. Yeah.
Of course, in that connection, though, when looking upon the world market, and where many of the countries buy from the same source, namely the Arabs, where the price of gasoline has been at least twice as high for years and years and years in many of the other markets of the world as compared to the United States. And in many of those instances, the distribution of the oil is even controlled more by the government than it is in any other way, and where the gasoline has been so much higher all through these years. And I wondered, you know, what the reason was for that. Was it because, you know, the government was gouging its own people? Probably not.
If you call it gouging, the taxes in Europe have been historically much higher on gasoline than in the United States. And also because Europe, on average, had to transport its oil longer distances or over less favorable terrain, the cost of getting
that's part of cost of production again,
yeah.
which
But I believe anybody know for sure now the tax? What have the taxes been? Anybody driven in Europe, say 3 or 4 years ago? What were the taxes on a gallon of petrol?
Who pays any attention to the tax? You just pay the amount.
Yeah,
you have
yeah.
To pay.
But the taxes tended to be a good bit higher.
Yeah, you pay $1 a gallon.
Yeah, and of course, as a result, by the way, Europeans tend to drive smaller cars.
And
part of that was due to, in particular areas where they were trying to, say, downplay an automobile economy, because they realized that everything they had to get for the automobile had to be imported.
Mm-hmm.
Raw materials, and particularly Scandinavia, they had to almost fight an automobile economy, and one of the ways to fight it was by charging high taxes, so that only a few people could afford them.
Yeah. Okay, but let's come back to the question of how much monopoly power the oil industry has. Barbara?
There was one observation that when the price controls came off, the last price controls to come off was gasoline. For a long time, the price of gasoline was controlled and other commodities were not. And it occurred to me almost that as soon as those price controls came off, the prices just really went up, almost as if the oil companies had been pouting and said, okay, the government, we'll show you who has the power and who can control the price.
Well, Barbara, there's another explanation. When the government puts a price control on, and then the government is squeezing down on something, and the spring is trying to push it up, when you take it off, it's going to go up. Not because anybody's pouting, but because, you know, when the government put price controls on, what the government did was interfere with the standard rationing system. I mean, look, here the fundamental principles of economics are these. If people want more of anything than they can obtain without having to give up something else to get it, that good is scarce. Most things are scarce. Anything that is scarce has to be rationed. Rationing implies some discriminatory criteria. Once you establish the discriminatory criteria, people will compete to establish credits. Now, put that in conventional language. If there isn't enough for everybody to have all he wants, we got to parcel it out. And the standard way to do it is ration it by means of money prices. Money then becomes the rationing criterion, and people compete to get money. Now, when the government freezes a price, like it did with gasoline, we suspend the rationing system. What took its place? What did people pay in addition to money in order to qualify for gasoline?
Time.
Time, right. Time was the principal thing. And frankly, I was very happy when the government took off the price controls and the price would go back up, because I could now spend less time getting gasoline. And I found the additional price per gallon that I paid was worth less to me than the time I had spent.
However, as many commentators have pointed out, that has effectively excluded the poor. That is to say, it's still a rationing system. It's just a rationing system that benefits the rich, and isn't that simple?
Well,
works to the detriment of the poor.
I'm not sure that's completely true. You see, it is true, of course, that when you ration by means of money price, you discriminate against people who don't have a lot of money.
Sure.
That's the meaning of being poor. Mm-hmm. Meaning of being poor means to be at a disadvantage with respect to the standard rationing system in the United States. If we try to eliminate that disadvantage, let me point out, we have completely eliminated the rationing system. In other words, suppose we said, we are now going to allocate scarce goods on the basis of virtue. Well, let me just suppose. And then we struggle to make everyone seem equally virtuous, that we would have ruined our rationing system, that we'd have to go to height. But then if we lopped off and added on and make... I mean, If you're going to discriminate on the basis of some any rationing system, if you're going to use some particular discriminatory criteria, you have to be sure that if everybody has the same amount of it, at least it is expendable. You know, so if you're going to discriminate on the basis of virtue, then you have to make sure that either people have different virtues, or there are different degrees of virtuousness, or when I buy something on the basis of my virtue, they take some of my virtue away. But, you know, on the question, and it gets into your larger question, I think that while in the short run, a higher price for gasoline, well, no, not even in the short run. You see, one of the things that, you know, the poor people are more likely to have one car and work from 8 to 5. And so they had a great deal of trouble getting gasoline. The wealthier people, you'd send the wife out to the station in the second car during the day, and the next day you take that car and she fills up the next tank, and she could get in there at 11 o'clock in the morning when there were no lines. And there were people who were, you know, working people had more trouble than the upper class. And over, I'm convinced that the automobile has, over time, discriminated seriously against the poor. In our cities, the automobile has destroyed the public transportation system. And moreover, it's created the whole pattern of living in our cities, which has said, the automobile is designed to serve people who can afford to buy automobiles and get out and live out in the semi-country called the suburbs, and then come zipping through the area where the poor people live, dumping their noxious fumes upon them and so on. So I think that if the government were to impose a dollar a gallon tax on gasoline, which I'm in favor of, but I have no hope that the federal government would do anything so wise as that. If the government were to do it, I think within 5 years, the poor would be much better off than they are now. But back to the question of how much monopoly power the oil companies have. Notice that there are oil producers, and there's scads of them. And they were so competitive that they've always tried to get the government to control production. That was the function of the Texas Railroad Commission, euphemistically so-called. But the only thing it did was railroad us into higher prices. But the federal government cooperated by passing the Connolly Hot Oil Act. That's not this Connolly, that's the old Connolly. So that there was clearly competition among the producers. Then there are the refiners, lots of refiners, and lots of refineries. And you think of the big refineries, and you forget about all the smaller refineries. Now, how many of you have ever bought a gallon of Kerr McGee? See, if you live in a certain part of the country, how many of you have bought Husky? Well, those of you who buy Kerr McGee don't usually buy Husky, you know. And you go around the country, and there are all kinds of... How about Clark? You travel a lot.
So I've been in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
That's all right. Now, this is a problem that I can't resolve in my own mind yet. Why? I could go to one station with, I'd say, for basically better-known brand names of industry. You'd pay 60-some cents a gallon. I could come in and find a Husky station at 52 or 54. Say, 10 to 12 cents a gallon spread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't figure why does the big boy sit over here with 12 cents a gallon more than Husky sits over here?
Because people will pay it. Now the question is, why will people pay it? One of the reasons is the convenience of the credit card.
Yeah, but I paid cash both places.
Well, but yeah, all right.
But I don't have a credit card.
Why were you so...
I got stuck. It wasn't on the lower price.
Well, you weren't watching then, huh? You weren't careful. You know what you were doing? You were speculating. Right, here's an example of speculation. Everybody hates the speculator. But when you drive along, you see a sign that says 57.9. You say, I can do better. And you run out of gas. You were or if you get to the next town and it's 62, you're an unsuccessful speculator. It's interesting. When people think that prices are going to be lower up ahead, they drive with less gas in their tanks. So one of the ways to get... Did you ever think about this? One of the ways to get Americans to store gasoline in a crisis is to convince them that prices are going to go up. Do you ever think how much storage capacity there is in the back of our cars? You think of the difference in a large city between if everybody's keeping his tank full and everybody's keeping... And then think of all... Then there are all the gasoline stations. They have these enormous tanks. They can be full or empty. And then there are the jobbers that have tanks can be full or empty. And the refiners that have tanks. And now you begin to understand why prices used to fluctuate a good deal and still do fluctuate to some extent. Because in the winter, when they're turning out a lot of fuel oil and the gasoline is kind of a byproduct, gasoline begins to pile up, and first the refiner's tanks get full. And they say that the jobber takes them. The jobber says, I don't want to buy that gasoline. I can't sell it at this time of the year. They say, well, fill up your tanks and store. He says, why should I? Well, we'll give you a break in the price. So the jobber fills his tanks up. And then jobbers, they say, buy some more. And he says, darn it, I can't. So he goes to all the gasoline stations. He says, hey, why don't you guys just store all this gasoline for me, those tanks, down beneath the concrete? They say, why should we? We can't sell it at this time of the year. And he says, well, I'll give you a cut in the price. And so they say, all right, and they load up. And now they're full up, and the jobber's pressing them to take more. So they say to the customer, hey, why don't you load up your tank with gasoline? Why should I? I'm not driving it. Well, I'll give you a cut in the price. And that's the way the prices come up. And that's a very competitive process. You can trace it out. There have been studies. That you can see, when the weather gets colder, the price of gasoline goes down in the Chicago area. Now, it used to. I don't know how it's working right now. See, but the problem now is the government still has some important price controls on there, and that intervention makes it more difficult to predict just exactly what's going to happen. One of the things, and I'm sounding like a defender of the oil industry, right?
Tell us about your stock portfolio.
Yeah. two weeks ago, there was a group of women up here from the Washington Federation of Women's Club, and they're having a conservation seminar. And I was talking to them on the economics of the energy crisis, and I began by telling them that I own no stock in any oil company. Matter of fact, I own no shares of stock. I simply made a decision some years ago that I was not going to own any shares of stock because I was afraid of the bias effect, and I wanted to be able to tell people that I don't. The bias effect. I thought it would bias my judgment on things. And also, I find ways to spend it. But anyway, I gave this speech, and someday Chris Comstock, who heads the Forest Service for the whole Chelan District, he was up. He was talking to me. He came to my talk a little late, didn't hear that introductory remark, and he was talking to me afterwards out there. And then he said, "Well, what do you do for Shell Oil?" Well, I was a guy on the program from the Shell Oil Company. He just assumed from my talk that I must be he. But I have, for years, I have attacked the oil industry, its political power, its hypocrisy. But I've shifted around because the oil industry, I'm convinced now, is getting really a bad rap. The one way in which the oil industry has been responsible for our present troubles is that the international cartels, which have been established, now note this, with the blessing of the State Department, aided OPEC in raising its price. And that was also done with the blessing of the State Department.
What's your proof for that?
Hmm?
In what way?
Oh, the documents of the State Department, and it's no secret. The State Department has, for reasons that are very obscure, the man who has written an awful lot on this, because he's hated it all along, is a guy named Morris Edelman at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Now, the question is, would the OPEC countries have been able to do it without the cooperation? You see, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries is a group of sovereign states that have the usual problems of sovereign states in cooperating. We sometimes say the Arab countries, but it isn't just the Arab countries. One of the ringleaders has been Venezuela. But what all of a sudden enabled them to get together? Well, I don't know. I think antagonism toward Israel on the part of a substantial number of them, mixed with this general antagonism toward the United States, where the United States then was seen as an ally, suddenly created a kind of community of interest. But I wonder whether that community of interest could have been made effective enough to jack up the price without the cooperation of the big oil companies. And here's why. See, if you get the price of oil up to $12 a barrel, you can't keep it up there without cutting back production. And now every country is going to experience a temptation. They can take the stuff out of the ground at a fraction of $12 a barrel. And so what you want everybody else to restrict his production while you increase your production and sell on the sly. That's what breaks down cartels. But what kept that from happening, or what made it relatively easy to keep that from happening, was the fact that all these countries sold their petroleum through some of these major international oil company cartels. So they kind of had a marketing agent who could ride herd on all of them. And they gave the marketing agent an incentive to ride herd on them by requiring the marketing agent to pay a certain amount and then leave it up to the marketing agent to make sure that the price didn't fall.
Paul, would you venture what the State Department's motive would be in that?
It seems to be
grand picture to Henry Kissinger.
It long antedates Kissinger. It's been a policy of years. I think it comes from the American policy of friendliness towards Saudi Arabia and the other Persian Gulf oil producing countries.
From Cold War, maybe.
No, I think. I'm not sure what it comes from.
Well, isn't it just our basic policy of protecting American companies in whatever foreign country they
yeah.
are?
Yeah, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Make for smoother relationships between Aramco and Saudi Arabia.
Which brings up, I think, the fact that oil companies in particular and other multinational corporations are more governments than any state government are.
Well, that's another question, the multinational corporation. And, you know, it's getting to be almost time for the coffee bell to ring. I've got 8 minutes.
10:15, Paul.
Yeah, well, I can't, but when that bell rings, everybody flits out. And we've been spending a lot of time just on this question of market power, and we looked at automobiles and oil, and I hope I've at least sowed some doubts in your mind about how much market power these sellers have. And now notice, somebody has to know, when the government and businesses get in league, then we're in trouble. That's very important. If you find a producer who really has you by the throat, chances are he's in league with the government. State of Washington is liquor sold competitively. there are all kinds of examples where you can't get a lower price because the government has made it illegal. State governments are very bad on this account. I think the national government, Congress is about to repeal at long last the Miller-Tidings Act, which legalizes resale price maintenance agreements, so-called fair trade, which is really a laws that exempt employers and retailers from the Sherman Antitrust Act when they conspire to fix retail prices. And the Congress, I think, is about to remove that exemption, and that will increase competition.
That'll be good news.
That'll be very good news.
You say it would also be good news if the government put a dollar a gallon tax on gas. What else would you recommend?
I got lots of revenue. Not now. I really want to finish the big picture. I'm going to just take a quick look at the big picture. But there are obviously aspects of the problem of economic power that we haven't touched on, that I haven't touched on, but which you have introduced, and I want to say something about them. Sir?
Well, you were asked before, which impact did I the most as an individual? What about the health care delivery system?
You know, we're going to talk about that tomorrow night. There's going to be a forum on that tomorrow night. Health care delivery systems. And maybe we can get into that. Are there any monopolists in the health care delivery system? And why is the American Medical Association a monopolist? But I think better still, we can look at some of the ways in which we are caught. You know, like how do hospital administrators behave, and why do they behave in those ways? Under what pressures do they act? And it turns out that there are lots of people just acting in their own interest, and the result is something that is in nobody's particular interest. But anyway, and there'll be other aspects too. We're going to have a fellow named Dan Olson. He's going into his residency now, and he's very interested in talking about some of the misunderstandings between patients and doctors. We'll probably get into malpractice. We'll get into the consuming desire for antibiotics, and I suppose Barb is going to say something, good and bad bacteria, you'll lay the ground.
Yeah, I can talk about antibiotics tomorrow.
Okay. All right, well, do. Anyway, at Holden Village, everything ties together. Can I? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to ask about if the automobile industry had, you know, things as tight as they did, it's helped me to understand, or is this a fallacious concept? You know, they pulled some strings so they wouldn't be in the situation where they are right now if they really had as much clout as we think they had.
Yeah, yeah. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith is the guy who has been more responsible than any other single person for encouraging the belief that there are some industries, automobiles the main one, that so control advertising and the mind of the consumer and the production process and the councils of government that they can get anything they want. And Galbraith says what they want above all is a quiet and secure life, and they make sure there's always an adequate demand for automobiles. Well, then how come Chrysler is going bankrupt? How come American Motors struggles on from year to year? How come Ford and General Motors are experiencing such bad times? You know, maybe not bad times from the standpoint of some other industries, but General Motors, you know, has been making 20% on investment at least for years and years and years. One year they fell below 19%. But the last couple of years, this disaster has struck. So, these are good things to keep in mind. I had some data down here on corporate profits. Let me just fire this up. Some people, they had this picture that the corporation is getting bigger and bigger and getting more and more profits. Well, I just pulled out of the income and product accounts of the federal government the figures on total corporate profits for 1947, 57, 67, and 73. I picked these years because they're all good years. They're 10 years apart. I can't get 77 yet. Sometimes we economists just make them up. But total corporate profits in 47 were about $26 billion, in 57 about $46 billion, in 67 $79 billion, in 73 $105 billion. Say, wow. But of course, if you deflate those for changes in the price level, it doesn't look quite that bad. But the important thing is to take those as a percentage of the total national income. And then you find that they've been declining steadily. Corporate profits as a percentage of total national income. That would be wages and salaries, rent, interest, the profits of farms, the profits of single proprietorships, partnerships, doctors, dentists, that's the total national income. You put everybody's income together and you take corporate profits as a percentage of that. It was about 13% right after World War II. It's been slowly sliding down toward 12%. In the last couple of years, it's dropped down below 10%. But it's not true. It's been taking off. Then some people say, well, but corporations are getting bigger and bigger. But big relative to what? What's the relevance of bigness? Well, an elephant is big. But to a mosquito, so is a marten, or a swallow. What is big? Is A&P big? Yeah, A&P's big. Here's one. Who's bigger, McDonald's or Lucerne Resort? Well, McDonald's, obviously. And yet, what's the relevance of that? If you can counter a McDonald's, you can expect a better hamburger at a lower price than when you get down here to Lucerne Resort. I'm not knocking Lucerne Resort, but they're awful big relative to the competition. Which is Steakin, where the hamburgers are just as small. There's the whole question of the conglomerates, a movement of the last 15 years about which I am alarmed, simply because I don't like to see anything that's big get bigger unless I can see some good social reason for it. And I can't see very many good social reasons for the growth of these conglomerates. I can see some small advantages, let me add. One of the, you know what I mean by conglomerate? Firm that's producing, it's basically in the business of producing automobiles, all of a sudden buys a refrigerator company. There are some firms that aren't in the basic business of producing anything. They own shoe polish, baked beans.
tobacco
companies have been conglomerating because they're afraid the tobacco business is going to slide out from under them, which is a smart idea. But one of the advantages of this is that it forces some firms that have been badly managed to behave more efficiently. Some people say, well, gee, when a corporation is widely held, when the stock is widely spread out among the public, how do the stockholders force a lazy, incompetent, stupid management to get on the ball? Well, when there are conglomerates floating around, roaming about seeking whom they might devour, that tells the managers of inefficient enterprises to get on the stick. Because when you're not managing well, your stock price falls to reflect the expected value of low future earnings. And then somebody comes along and says, hey, we could buy up a controlling interest of that, manage the place efficiently, the stock would shoot up, and we'd make a profit. So there are some advantages to the conglomerate movement.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's ridiculous for the United States to bail out Pennsylvania Railroad, for instance?
Oh, yeah. Because the problem is the United States put the Pennsylvania Railroad in that position in part. We established the Interstate Commerce Commission in 1887 because it was obvious that you couldn't have enough railroads running from Peoria to Gilman to have competition. Since competition is impossible, since there's a natural monopoly here, we will regulate. Then along came the trucks. And instead of concluding that it now was possible to have enough shippers serving from Peoria to Gilman to have competition and abolishing the regulation of the railroads, we brought the trucks under regulation. And that's a clue to something, which I just might mention. Regulation is usually obtained by the initiative of the regulators. You can go, you know, there's a, one of the myths of regulation is that Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle, and then the American public and Congress in its wrath rose and regulated the meat industry. Not true. For 25 years prior to that, the big meat packers had been demanding federal regulation of the meat industry because they figured it would drive the small competitors out of business. And they finally got it, thanks to Upton Sinclair. it's all in the record. I got a copy recently of the Trucking Association's hotline warning the truckers that there's a big movement on to abolish the Interstate Commerce Commission, which regulates us. And they say, oh, that will be awful, won't it, when we're no longer regulated, you know, because obviously we want somebody to keep us from charging extortionate prices. Anyway, you asked about the Penn Central. The whole regulation system has created a lot of the problems of the railroads. Because the railroads then respond. They know that the government is going to take care of them, or they think the government is going to take care of them, so they operate accordingly. Then the government has set up special rules for railroad workers. It's almost impossible to lay them off. It's an enormous mess. I don't know what to do about it. Well, I don't know. Let me say that. Maybe that will give me an opportunity. Oh, boy. That bell's going to ring, and there's seven important things I haven't told you yet. I just want to throw out some quick suggestions. The Arabs. As the Arabs buy stuff in the United States, don't get scared. The Arabs are setting up multinational corporations. And multinational corporations, it seems to me, are good things.
Except that they're buying
arms. Well, they're buying what? Well, all right. Well, yeah, but it's the Arab countries that are buying arms. It's not the multinational corporations.
The Arabs. Not buy it, the Arabs or the Jack?
I don't care, but let them both buy it, because the way to get some other people in another country to love us is to have them own a piece of us. You know, nobody likes to bomb his own real estate. My vision of an ideal world is a group of Arabs operating a Miami hotel frequented by New York Jews, whom they struggle to serve, whom they're serving them kosher food, and worrying about the declining profit margins because the fuel bills have gone up and transportation costs are so high because the Arabs are charging so much for oil. That's what we call an international community of interest. And the fear that the Arabs can somehow ruin our country if they own Iowa farmland or Miami hotels or New York banks is really wrong. Those resources are still based in the United States, and the United States government finally has control over them. And let's remember that when it comes also to U.S. multinational corporations operating abroad. I think the notion that multinational corporations can call the shots and have all this power over everybody is basically mistaken again. Those corporations live in fear and trembling. They operate in so many different countries, subject to the rules, the arbitrary rules of so many different governments. Now, when United Brands pays an enormous bribe to political officials in Guatemala, some people say, see, that proves how much power they have. It seems to me that proves how powerless they are, that they've got to pay these enormous bribes. Now, the problem of multinational corporations is obviously much more complex than that. That was just one thing to think about. Then let's see. I'll just come back to your question and then I'm going to quit. This business of the control of our social life and the control of our style of life, I think that we are having a tendency here to blame. We don't like to accept responsibility ourselves for things that we have done. We also do not like to think that the responsibility for a deteriorating situation rests with kind of everybody, because if it does, then we don't know any way to control it, and we feel kind of powerless. Now, I think that the automobile has been, well, I go along with Ezra Machan, who says that the automobile is the worst disaster to befall the human race in the 20th century. That was his original statement. He subsequently revised it to be the worst technological disaster to befall the human race in its entire history. Mm-hmm. I believe that, but I do not think that the automobile company or the oil companies or any other narrow group of interests has been responsible for it. We have all participated in this. And it's important to recognize that, because until we all change, we're not going to get any change. And the automobile companies are simply giving us what we want. The automobile companies have several times tried to give the American public what it did not want. Example was Ford's campaign about 15 years ago to make automobiles safer. And the American public bought General Motors cars in droves. They didn't want safety. Look at the seat belts. The automobile companies didn't mind putting seat belts in, but people didn't want to pay for them. Moreover, people sometimes just objected to having the dumb things in the car. And you say, well, don't people want to live? Sure they want to live. But when people buy a car, they're not thinking of safety. They're thinking of rah! And they don't want to be reminded that these things crack up. I am very concerned about style of life and the role of the productive system in feeding into a destructive style of life. But I insist that the basic responsibility lies with us as individuals, because we are all participating in that. I notice that producers do not have any very clear common class interest, that they have more conflicts of interest than commonalities of interest. And they just have a heck of a time getting together and controlling our style of life. Moreover, the large corporations even, and the small businesses, it is even more true, that when it comes to the political arena, and where we sometimes think they're terribly powerful, if you look at it now in detail, you'll find that the potential advantage to them from a dollar investment in political action is probably much less than a dollar, which is why they don't really do a lot of political acting. Sure, they tossed some contributions toward Richard Nixon, but did those give them much political influence? I'm not talking about making of ceremonial contributions or contributions that are just, you know, sort of designed to keep you from getting in hot water, where they sort of all cancel out anyway. I'm talking about actual political action, effective political action, like Mayor Daley engages in. Businesses generally find that, except when it comes to their own narrow commercial interests, and where they're all competing against one another, they don't have much of an interest in getting involved in politics. So I don't think they do control our political life. I really think that our political life has gone to the devil. But it isn't because of business or big corporations. But it's really past the coffee. Why didn't they ring the coffee bell?
Oil control in Texas legislature
over this. Well, you know, oil controls the thinking of Texans. That's really the problem.
The automobile may be that curse you speak of, but none of us would be here without it. Oh,
well,
not a one of us. I don't think we'd make it the Holden Village without the automobile.
Well, but see, if there weren't an automobile, we would have better public transportation.
What?
If there weren't the automobile, we would have better public transportation than we could all have.
I wouldn't be here without it.
Well,
if trains were really good and really on time and a lot of people.